I haven't done this for a long time, so sorry. I'm going to talk about CODL, which is work that was primarily done by Kathy Nichols, and I worked on a couple of small pieces of it. And I'll spend a lot of time on my small pieces and talk a little bit about the more profound things that she did. It's a way of dealing with buffer bloat, of the huge queues that we're seeing inside of today's routers. Now, as soon as you think about huge queues, the picture that probably jumps into your head is this one. This is what I see driving to and from work every day. This is congestion. The thing that we're seeing in routers bears absolutely no resemblance to this. It's fundamentally different. The mechanisms are different. What you see on the outside, big delays, that's the same. But what's going on inside is completely different. An important difference is, even though one bozo can cause this, there's no one thing you can do that would fix this. When you've got a congestion problem, it's a very distributed, very large-scale problem, and you have to fix lots of things in order to fix the problem. And those things can be hard to fix, you know, like putting in public transit so people don't have to drive, ramping up gas prices so there are fewer cars on the road, things that have big impacts on society and lots of people. That's not what's going on with buffer bloat, and that's not what's going on with the queues that we see inside of routers. It's good news because it means you can do one thing and fix it. You fix one router and suddenly life is a whole lot better for the person who sees that router as a bottleneck. Now, a thing that's impeded progress is you got this model in your head. I want to give you a better physical model. It's probably this. So this is a fountain from somewhere in England. This is a closed loop servo system. You suck water out of that pond, push it up a pipe into the air, falls back down into the pond, then a pump picks it up, and it just keeps circulating. That's how a transport connection works. This is a better model because intuitions that you build up from this model can actually directly apply to gateways. Like the first question is, does the water level in the pond have anything to do with the flow rate through that fountain? If I crank the pump way up so the water's shooting up in the air a lot higher, falling back down the fountain, does that change the level of the pond? No. If I increase the pipe so a lot more water is moving through, does it change the level of the pond? No. Can I make the level of the pond anything I want to be? I can bucket out some water and it goes down. I can pour in more water, it goes up until it hits that overflow pipe. So that pond's the queue that's used in this closed loop servo system, right? It provides a backlog to keep the pump from pumping air and stalling out. I can make that queue be anything I want, independent of the operation of the pump. So the height of the water column's the delay of the pipe, of the path, the diameter of the pipe is a bandwidth of the path. Right? I can change those, not going to change anything about the level. I can change the level, it's not going to change anything about the height of the column or the amount of water that's flowing through it. This is a pretty good representation of a gateway. Here's another representation of a gateway from a paper in 86 or so. So packets coming from the sender, starts up, launches a burst of packets. They go flying through a wire till they hit a fast to slow transition. There they're going to stop because as you're going into that wire, these packets that were real close together in time, they've got to stretch out to go from the higher bandwidth to the low. And while the first one's stretching out, all the guys behind him have to wait until he goes through. Now, vertical dimensions, bandwidth, horizontal dimension is time. Bandwidth times time is bits, right? So the area of each one of those boxes is the size of the packet. Packet doesn't change size as you go through the network. So as you smash it down in bandwidth, it's got to stretch out in time. When it puffs out on the other side of the constriction, it doesn't go back together again, right? Once you spread them out, they're spread. Packet hits the receiver, gets turned into an ACK. The ACKs go back, they get turned into packets. This is one round trip time later, and you can see a packet's about to rise at that queue. Packet's about to go in the pipe. At this point, that 5-packet queue can't go away. It's just like the pond in the pump, right? In that pump example, we pull water out of the bottom, comes out the top, drops back into the pond. So as stuff is arriving at the top, an exactly equal amount is going out at the bottom. So what's happening here, right? Packet is going into the wire, but at exactly the same time, a packet's arriving from the other side. It's running in detail balance and perfect flow balance. And since one's arriving, one's leaving, you get minus one plus one within one packet time, and the queue stays constant. That's buffer bloat. Right? That's what's going on in the gateway. It doesn't have any analog in Erlang traffic theory, because they believe running a pipe at 100% is impossible. You can't do that with Poissonian traffic. It wouldn't be Poissonian. You get correlations at 100%. This is the way every bottleneck runs, is at 100%. That's why we see these standing queues. They can be caused by a single traffic flow. It's not the superposition of a zillion cars on a roadway. It's not lots of different connections happening. It's one thing using a huge TCP window. Some words to go along with this. So you get a queue at a fast to slow transition. For any particular path, there can only be one slowest point. So for any given flow, there's a single bottleneck, the slowest point on that path. And when you spread the stuff out, every other point on the path is already spread out, so it's not going to change. That means the queue shows up at that one bottleneck, at the slowest point, because after that, all the traffic spread out, so it doesn't need to queue anywhere else. Because the internet is sparse, that's where it gets its economy. That's why it grew to cover the entire planet. It's very likely there's just going to be one bottleneck, particularly for residential, home office, small users. They're sitting out on the end of a skinny tail. They may have a fat home network, but there's a skinny tail that's connecting to them to the internet. And it's likely that the two ends of that tail are the bottleneck for all traffic for that user. That's a case that we'd particularly like to fix. So we've got a queue. It's at this bottleneck. You've got exactly two choices. You can put in a bigger bottleneck somewhere else. Right? There's only going to be one. There can only be one slowest point. And so you can move the queue from where it is to somewhere else. The only way you can do that is to have a slower point. You've got to throw away some bandwidth to do that. There have been about a dozen AQM algorithms, queue management algorithms, show up in the literature over the past couple of years. They've all involved moving the queue somewhere else. And it's this little magician's trick where you say, fairy dust. Look, the queue has gone away. Don't look behind the curtain, because it's actually over there. You're not fixing the problem. You've still got the delay of that queue. In fact, the delay has to be worse because you move the queue somewhere else by putting in a lower bandwidth, which means that the same amount of data takes more time. So it's a longer queue in time, but it may not be at this place. Other alternative is to cooperate with the endpoints to get rid of the queue. And if they don't cooperate, you throw away the packets and get rid of the queue anyway. But really make it go away. The work that we're doing on CODL is the second one, is make the queue go away. Don't hide it somewhere else. In order to make it go away, you got to make sure you make the right thing go away. There's a notion of good queue and bad queue. In order to get that connection started that was shown in the TCP slide, you need the queue to sit there as a shock absorber. The endpoint doesn't know how fast the path is, right? So it launches packets as fast as it can. They go through till they hit the bottleneck, and the bottleneck spreads them out. That's what it's supposed to do. That's how the internet works in the presence of extremely heterogeneous bandwidth. Good thing, right? That queue is wonderful. So there's the queue doing its job. If you measure that queue length over time, there's this big burst of packets arriving, and then they get metered out at the bottleneck rate. And then here's where we go in the steady state. There's that constant backlog. The queue that's sitting in that peak at the front, that's good queue. That's queue doing its job. You can see it doing its job, and it goes away as it's doing its job. This queue that's sitting at the end, that's just adding delay. It's not helping anybody. It's not increasing the throughput. It's not doing rate adaptation. It's just slowing you down. There isn't a static algorithm for figuring that out. Right? There isn't a number you can measure and say, oh, this queue is working just fine for me, but I want to get rid of this stuff. It's hard to pull it apart. What's typically used is some sort of averaging, but here's an example of an ACK per window TCP, something that Microsoft did and Solaris did because it made a fairly sucky protocol stack look a lot better in tests. Having bigger bursts amortize the cost quicker is completely legal. It's nasty for the network, but completely legal. So burst of packets, they get metered in. One ACK for the entire window gets returned, so there's another burst of packets, and so on. So we're hammering the gateway pretty hard. It keeps doing its job, right, putting those packets in. The queue, the minimum queue is zero. Right? It's just getting all of the packets in a burst rather than smoothly up here, so it doesn't level out. But you wouldn't want to take that queue away. The average of these spikes is about the average of that flat spot. So if you take a mean and you try to control based on mean queue level, you're going to be stupid. You're going to drop packets in that thing, and you're going to impact its throughput. What you'd really like to do is detect this, but never discriminate against things like that. So how can you do that? Well, this good queue, it goes away. The burst of packets get fed into the downstream pipe, and new ones don't arrive. So you know, the picture we're getting here, queue goes up, and then it goes back down again. And that happens over the period of a round-trip time. The stuff that doesn't go away in a round-trip time, that's the bad stuff. That's the stuff that you don't want sitting there. A good way of separating the good stuff and the bad stuff, therefore, is take the minimum of this thing. The lowest point that you get to is all of the stuff that went away. So if I ran a sliding window across that trace and took the minimum in the window, then I'd have a measure that separates the good queue from the bad queue. There's a picture of it. So there's a sliding window. That thick line is the minimum, and it's the minimum of all the points in the window. Right. So as the window is walking down here, this thin line is the data points, is picking the smallest data point in the window, which is going to be this one, since it's monotone decreasing, and that's the minimum, which is that thick line. Now, this does, let's go over here, this does a really great job when the minimum point is inside the window, which is that wide. As soon as the window slides past the min, then it jumps up to the minimum of these two sides. That's not good. So this is the good queue, bad queue boundary, but then we get something that's not the good queue, bad queue boundary. Why? Because that window is too narrow. We need to cover the entire cycle, which is around trip time. Now, in general, internet connections, round trip time can be a lot of different things. It can be adjacent to in a couple of milliseconds, can be across the country, 50, 100 milliseconds, can be other side of the world, 200 milliseconds. If you make the window too wide, no big deal. Because you can have lots of minimums inside, and so you get a more robust estimator, separate the good queue and the bad queue. If you make it too narrow, you're going to decide that you've got bad queue when you don't, and you're going to start to drop packets. Now, going back to one bottleneck on a path for all paths. So you've got an algorithm that you'd like to stick in a lot of gateways. You don't know which one of them are going to be the bottleneck gateway. may change over time as the internet evolves, as the connections evolve. You want an algorithm that does no harm so that you can stick it in every gateway and it only turns itself on when there's really a problem. And it never turns itself on otherwise. So the first principle of design for an active queue management algorithm, one that you'd like to be widely deployed, one that doesn't take any babysitting, you know, one that you pull a box off the shelf, it's got the AQM, it's turned on, and you never care because that's never going to hurt you. The one design principle that makes that possible is to say, do no harm. Never drop a packet unless you're absolutely sure that dropping that packet is going to make things better. Better to do nothing than to do the wrong thing. So as far as separating good queue and bad queue, use a pretty big time window. If you do that, then you're really reliably going to find a minimum that tells you what's good and what's bad. Next question, once you separate good and bad, how do we measure the size of the queue? What number are we feeding into our min? There's two obvious alternatives. The one that we started one with, and the one that's still used today, is measure the queue size in bytes. We started with that because in the 1970s and 1980s, when we were first doing networking, memory was incredibly expensive. An IMP had 4 kilobyte buffers, and the memory for that was tens of thousands of dollars, and I was coding for an IMP on a PDP-1, which had 1 kilobyte of memory. Actually, it had 1K of 12-bit memory, which isn't really a kilobyte, but kind of felt like it. Because memory was so expensive and so tiny, the amount of memory really mattered to us. And we sized all the queues in bytes, and we kept track of those bytes because they were precious. Well, you can't buy a chip smaller than a gigabyte today. And we just don't think about memory. Measuring queues in terms of bytes is really a pain in the butt if you're doing a queue management algorithm, because we don't care about overfilling it, we care about the delay that it causes. And in order to translate bytes into delay, you've got to know bandwidth. But bandwidth isn't constant, it can change over time. And so you've got an algorithm that can rest on sand because the thing that you want to control, which is the delay through the queue, depends on this number that's very hard to know, which is bandwidth. So as I was busy writing comb and filter algorithms to look at departure times and try and reliably estimate the bandwidth associated with the queue, Kathy kind of shook her head and said, well, that's really stupid. You can measure the time, right? You know when the packet went in, you know when the packet came out. The difference between those two times is how long the packet took to go through the queue, which is the delay that that packet saw due to the queue. Why compute it when you can measure it? So that's called the sojourn time. It's a direct measure of delay that's trivial to compute. And delay is what we're trying to control. That's what we're trying to adjust. And if you measure the queue in terms of its delay, in terms of its sojourn time, then the actual implementation gets way simpler, because if you want the bytes in a queue, the NQ side is adding packets, the DQ side is removing packets. So at any given time, if you want the stuff that's actually in the queue, you need to coordinate the NQ and the DQ. If you want, you're in the DQ and you want to say, I want to know how many bytes are in the queue, you've got to stop the NQ in order to measure that number. That's nasty. It's nasty inside an OS because it requires locks, which slow you down. And it's seriously nasty if you've got a hardware-based pipeline, because hardware-based pipelines telling the other end of the pipeline to stop is seriously hard. If you're doing sojourn time, the NQ side puts a timestamp in the packet. The DQ side pulls the timestamp out of the packet and subtracts it from the current clock. No coordination at all. It's running entirely on the DQ side with no locks. So that's a nice implementation, independent of what your packet pipeline looks like. It's really cool inside of an OS. It's great in a hardware pipeline. It's great if you've got a mixed pipeline. if you got this measure, because you're automatically accounting for bandwidth, if the bandwidth goes down, the packets take longer to go through. So the time that you measure, that's the real time. And you don't have to get this difficult parameter, like in a Wi-Fi network, figure out how much bandwidth is really delivering you. There's a slide for this next one that if you actually look at the details of measuring a queue by the bytes that are in it, that's a really noisy signal. You got to filter the wazoo out of it to get data out of it. And if you've got more than one simple queue, if you've got a multi-queue structure, bytes is a really difficult thing to deal with. Let me do the first of those two. Top graph there is sojourn time. The bottom is exactly the same queue, exactly the same data, looking at the instantaneous bytes that are in the queue. So this bottom one is what we typically do in like the RED algorithm, almost anything that's measuring queue. The top one is Kathy's idea, great idea. This is looking at a single FTP with superimposed web traffic with a 10 millisecond link with an 10 megabit link with an 80 millisecond RTT. And it's TCP Reno, and you can see it's the congestion avoidance phase. It's doing this linear window ramp, and that's why we're seeing the queue. You may wonder why I shaded all those packets on the bottom black, but I didn't, so I'm going to blow up that region. So that's blowing up 200 milliseconds. Now you can start to see here, these are the individual packets. Now what's happening is, remember it's in flow balance, so in any packet time interval, one packet arrives, one packet leaves. That's the flow balance, detail balance. That's why the queue is persistent. The phasing between the arrival and the departure is random. They don't arrive and leave at the same time. So a packet is coming in, a packet is going out, and one packet gets removed from the queue at the instant that you get the completion interrupt of the previous one. A packet arrives in the queue when you get the completion interrupt of the one that's coming in. Those can be phased arbitrarily with respect to one another. And so you see this continuous oscillation, plus or minus one packet, at the packet or arrival rate. In every packet time, you'll see one up and one down. So it's twice the frequency of the packet arrival rate for ups and downs. The actual queue that you've got, you can only get by integrating those ups and downs, because it's a relative area of the amount of time you spend down to the amount of time you spend up. That's the actual bytes that are in the queue. And you can sort of see it in the sojourn time. If I was to carefully integrate this entire thing, I would see a little tiny web packet. There was about 100 bytes worth of web traffic. There's that little pedestal that's sitting up there. That's actually in all this garbage down at the bottom, but you can't see it because it's coded into relative areas of ups and downs. Takeaway of this is measuring bytes really sucks if you want to measure a queue. Sojourn time's easier, and it actually shows you what's going on. Talk a little bit about behavior with multiple queues. Another really nice property is sojourn time. So say I've got a multi-queue structure. I want to give isolation to different sets of traffic. Intuition is, if I'm running AQM on this thing and I'm doing pure round robin between these queues, right? So if I've got five packets that are arriving all in one queue, or five packets arriving at the same rate, departing at the same rate, but rather than all being in one queue, they're uniformly spread across the five queues. I would think if I have to do an AQM and I need to drop this case, I should be exactly the same drop rate, the same drop interval in this case, because it's the same traffic. It's just rather than spreading the packets out on this horizontal line, they're spread out vertically, but it's exactly the same traffic, same arrival, same departure, same queue delay. So if there was enough delay to drop it for the left-hand side, there should be on the right-hand side. That's impossible to do with something that's just measuring the queue volumes, because you have to look across all of the queues in order to get the interaction between them. If you're doing sojourn time, then the time that a packet takes to get from NQ to DQ includes the effect of all the other queues and the service discipline, right? It's implicitly including the behavior of the entire system rather than just that one little queue that it happens to be living in. So if you apply some AQM or some management algorithm to a queue measured in sojourn time, it actually reflects the entire queuing system as opposed to a single queue, which we observed when Eric Dumazet implemented FQ-Coddle, and it worked just brilliantly well, better than any FQ system that anybody has ever seen. And one observation was, it gets to leverage Kathy's sojourn time, so it gets a really good number for what it should control and what it should not control, which takes me into controlling queues. So the basic way of doing control is you measure the current state of the system. You have some model of what the system state should be, what the desired state of the system is. And if the current state isn't what you want, then you push on it somehow to get it to be what you want. Those three steps. That's the fundamentals of every control system. If you take C control systems 101, they'll tell you the formal names for that. Any servo system's got an estimation part, it's got a set point part, and then it's got a control loop part, the actual servo loop. We talked about the estimator. Have to deal with set point and control loop. Let's talk about set point. So that's saying, how much bad queue? We can now estimate, separate the good queue and the bad queue, so we know the stuff that's causing delay, not there as a shock absorber. Do we want to drive it to zero, or do we want some other number? Well, you can't drive it to zero if you're feeding an output link, because it means that you've got no packets to keep that link busy. And if your goal is to do no harm, then you better keep the bottleneck link busy, because the performance of the entire system is going to be the performance of that bottleneck link. And if you turn on this algorithm and suddenly that performance goes from 100% down to 90%, somebody's going to want to turn off the algorithm because it's doing harm. It's costing them throughput. And if you're on a really skinny link, that throughput's really important to you. So there's a minimum that you've got. You've got to have some backlog. How big a backlog? Well, remember that picture of the TCP connection. Packets get spaced out so that they're one packet time apart at the bottleneck link rate. Right, so if somebody's sending MTU-sized packets, then when you get one, the time until you get the next one is going to be the time it takes for an MTU to go through the link. Right? That's how the TCP self-clocking works. That's how you run at 100%. The queue stays pretty flat. So what that means is you better keep an MTU backlog, because if you throw that away, then it could take an MTU packet time before new traffic shows up, and the link will go idle for that amount of time. Right? So that's the minimum, and that just comes out of the connection dynamics. You'd actually, because we tend to ACK every other packet rather than every packet, you'd like to keep two packets worth of backlog, because you might get them in a two-packet burst rather than nicely one at a time. If you increase the queue above that, now, that's going to be negligible on a fast link, two packets. But slow link is a big deal. Above two packets, then you have an issue with how TCP congestion control works. Lose a packet, cuts the window in half, then it has to ramp it back up. It takes many round trip times to ramp it back up. And you're depending on the congestion control algorithm, your link utilization can suffer while it's ramping back up. The bigger you let the window be before you drop a packet, the less impact of cutting that window in half. You're not driving it down as deep. So there's a trade-off. You let that queue build up, you're getting some extra delay, but at low degree of multiplexing, you're increasing the throughput. Can you quantify it? Yeah, pretty easily. So this is a graph for Reno that as you increase the delay, so there's the delay expressed as a percentage of RTT, and the algorithm works in terms of round trip time. It adds a packet per round trip time. So it's, in a sense, scale free. All that matters is the fraction of RTT. And then this is the throughput. If you have no delay, you're going to get 75% of whatever the link bandwidth is. And if you studied it, you know that. If not, you probably don't care. And then it goes up like a square root of n. Matt Mathis and Jamshid Madhavi, if they're here, they'll tell you why it's square root of n. The delay is going up linearly as you add more queue. What we're interested in is the trade-off between bandwidth and delay. The way that you look at the trade-off is you take the ratio of bandwidth and delay. That's a term that's called power. And the power, if you look at it, it's pretty much linear down except right at the top. So I want to blow up just that region so that we can see it. There's blowing up first 30%. It's pretty flat up to about 5, and then it falls over and goes down. It says that you're getting a lot of bandwidth improvement for small change in delay up until about 5% of the RTT, and then you start to suffer. So draw it. You know, clearly the knee, you're on the downslide by the time you get to 10%. Get to 10%, you've thrown away 1% of your link bandwidth for cost of, you know, say, 10 milliseconds if it's 100 millisecond RTT with a delay. So that's kind of painful. You get something like 99.9% at a 5% delay increase. So yes, if you pick a set point value, a target value for your queue of 5% of the nominal RTT, then you get a big win in bandwidth for a very small increase in delay. Tiny impact on power. And this isn't a very narrow result. This holds pretty much independent of the congestion control algorithm that you're going to use. Is scale-free. It doesn't have bandwidth in it. It's only got RTT in it. So it doesn't matter if it's a fat link or a skinny link. All that matters is what the RTT is. And because the basic result just has to do with the dynamics of hole filling after you've got a loss, which is a property of TCP in general, not a particular congestion control algorithm, the result actually holds in general. And we tested that with Reno, Cubic, and Westwood, which are the three big families of congestion control algorithms. The test also tells you that Reno sucks pretty badly in terms of delivering bandwidth. Westwood sucks kind of badly in terms of delivering low delay. It wants to keep the pipe really, really full, and it's willing to overfill the queue to keep the pipe really full, and you have to bang it many times before it will drop its window down small. And Cubic is sort of the Goldilocks. It's not too little, not too much. It keeps the pipe really full, 99% almost all the time, but it keeps the delay really low. If you've got a set point of 5 milliseconds, it'll run at 1. So it's kind of a cool algorithm. I unfortunately did Reno. I wish I'd been smart enough to do Cubic. Put all this together, it says that CODL really has no free parameters. You need this nominal RTT, a big enough RTT, something bigger than the actual RTT of any connection going through the box, in order to separate the good queue and bad. And once you pick that number, it tells you what the set point should be, because you want about 5% of that number in order to keep the utilization of the bottleneck link being pretty high. And that really means you get a pretty much set it and forget it box. Right? You pick this one number, and everything else is determined. I'm not going to go into the algorithm and control law because I'm sure that I'm already over time. I want to say a little bit about implementation. So Eric Dumasay of Google did the initial Coddle implementation for Linux, which is now in the Linux 3.5 kernel. As part of doing that, he put in a stochastic fair queuing, FFQ system, really simple ones, taking the transport signature, running it through a very good hash, and then spreading it over 1024 queues. You can use anywhere between 256 and 1024 queues, and you get really great behavior. It provides great isolation, which means that if one piece of traffic is doing something stupid, nothing else suffers. It means if you've got low-rate video conferencing and low-rate web traffic, then they never get dropped. I mean, never get dropped, because you have to be in something big in order to get the time go up. A lot of the issues with IW10 go away because all that other traffic sees is the front of a queue, and you don't know how big its window is, and you don't care because you're not affected by it. And it increases utilization across your entire networking fabric because it gives you much better mixing, particularly when you've got bidirectional traffic, which compress the ACKs, make the traffic too bursty. There was a paper on this from Lucia Zhang and Dave Clark of MIT many years ago, and you can see it in simulations. If you've got bidirectional traffic, any AQM starts to suffer. You put in FQ-Coddle, no issue, just runs perfectly. If we're sticking code into boxes to deploy Coddle, don't do that. Deploy FQ-Coddle. I mean, it's just an across-the-board win. And as long as we're changing something, let's make a couple of changes at the same time. Current state of things is, thanks to some great work by Jim Giddies and the ACM, we have a publication of the Coddle algorithm in a paper journal. The intent, that paper, we would have liked to have spent another 6 months on it. It's not great, but it protects the ideas. The intent on the ideas is to make them public domain. Jim put us in touch with Evan Moglen of the Software Freedom Law Center, who said, patent office is so dysfunctional, the only way that you can protect the ideas is to get publication in a paper journal. Online publication doesn't count for the patent office. They're still in the 17th century. So we have now that paper publication, which we believe protects the ideas. There's an open source, dual license, GPL and BSD implementation that's available. It's available for NS2, NS3, and it's in the Linux kernel. And I believe all three have the same license, at least in the Coddle part. So there's a reference implementation. To the best of our knowledge, there is no prior art on these ideas. The ideas are original, and the intent was to make them public domain. We've been able to run it, and our top-level design goal of it does no harm seems to be met. We don't see it ever dropping when it shouldn't in simulation. It's pretty much set and forget it. And the experience of the people that have been running it have been, I think, uniformly good, that it doesn't ever hurt them, and the responsiveness of the links goes up enormously. There's some stuff that still needs to be done. We're still looking at some pieces of the algorithm, particularly the control law. You notice I waved my hands and skipped it. Well, there's some details in there that we think are not quite right, but all of the things that we're worried about are second order. There's not going to be huge, profound changes to the algorithm, but we don't think it's completely done. We'd like to see it on every end of residential and home office links. There's a lot of people that are suffering today on those links, and this would remove a lot of the suffering. But there's some deployment issues, and one of them is you really need to look at the details of the dequeuing process, see what the time structure is, because there's a lot of engineering involved in running a slow link efficiently, where slow link is a cable modem link, it's a 3G telephony link, 4G telephony link. They're all slow by today's internet speeds. Wi-Fi links oscillate between fast and slow. That's extremely interesting. What's the nature of that process? How does it interact with the per station queues, with the power management queues, with all of the goop that's inside a Wi-Fi to accommodate its really complex use environment? And you have to make sure that your AQM algorithm isn't fooled by all of that stuff and it doesn't drop packets at a time when it shouldn't. You know, power comes back on because your Wi-Fi battery has been sleeping, laptop's been sleeping to save battery, power comes back on, and the queuing algorithm says, oh, these packets are ancient, I should throw them all away. You're going to turn off the queuing algorithm because it just made the wrong decision. So we need to make sure that doesn't happen. This is getting to the last slides. So I said deployment issues. Here are some of the deployment issues. Got the home gateway scenario, which is usually a router combined with an access point. It's done in some commodity Linux box, you know, you get from Netgear or D-Link or Linksys. It's tied to a cable modem, which goes off to a head-end. If you're looking at that direction, between the router and the AP and the cable modem, there's 100 megabit or gigabit link. It's a fat pipe. And then you've got a few megabits or a few kilobits going upstream. So the fast to slow transition is right there. You can't hack that box. That box comes from cable labs or from a spec that was designed by cable labs. It's a pretty narrow spec, and they're not going to let you touch the queuing. We can hack this box. That's a Linux box. Eric has already hacked that box. So it's done, but the only way that we can run Coddle is to move the queue from here to here. So you can do that by putting a rate limiter in the router box to push the queue back into it, and then you can run Coddle on the queue that now shows up in front of your rate limiter. Otherwise, the queue goes down, forms in the cable modem, it's a big honking queue, and you see big delays. Early in the buffer bloat work, Jim documented those big delays. They're seconds of delays. I mean, they're really big delays. So problem is, when you move the queue back, you cut down the bandwidth on that link, because you've got to make a bottleneck that's skinnier than the one by cable modem. You also cut down a lot of the dynamic bandwidth in that link. So things like Comcast power boost just go away because you can't take advantage of it. Your rate limiter is a static thing and is blind to the downstream. So we kind of like to be in that cable modem. I think started talking to cable labs to see what's involved in getting there, but it's going to take a while. And in the while, we've got to implement something in that router that involves shifting the queue. That's a lot like the other generic problem, which is getting things into the Linux kernel. It's a similar situation. If you look at the kernel architecture of either Linux or BSD, there's a protocol stack that talks to, sends packets to a device driver. There's a queue between those two. And all of the queue scheduling and the queue management is done on this queue. The device driver then has to send packets down to a device. There's a queue between those two. We call it a descriptor ring because the device is hung out in an I/O bus and the driver is sitting inside the processor, but it's a queue. This queue is memory to memory. It's really, really fast. This queue is going across some dog slow I/O bus, right? PCI or PCI Express. It's really slow. All the queuing is going to happen at this point, and Coddle lives there. Oops. So what you need to do there is to make sure that you don't get the queuing at that point. You push the queue back up into the place where the OS can deal with it, where the AQM lives. And so there's a thing that Google did called byte counting that lets you push packets out of a device driver upstream. The problem is that really easy to apply to something like an Ethernet, which has got one queue, or maybe if you use the priority bits, it's got seven queues. But it's got very few queues, very simple service model. You try and put the same thing, byte counting, into a Wi-Fi driver, which has got four queues per station, and each of those queues has got four states. depending on whether you're in power management or expedited or as an AP, suddenly the problem is really nasty because the queue abstraction at this point can't even represent what the device is doing. And trying to push stuff out of the device driver where all of those details matter and that representation, that complication was put in because it's really critical for performance, trying to push it back out to a generic operating system interface is nearly impossible. So we don't have CODL in Wi-Fi, which is the place where we really, really want to get it. There's serious queuing problems. Probably byte counting is not the way to do it. It would be nicer if we could run CODL directly on the hardware queue abstractions, but figuring out exactly how to do that is hard.
We need to start taking some comments and wrapping up a little bit.
Yes, I want to do the last one, which is phones, which everybody sees with massive delays. Their situation is phone CPU talks to the onboard 3G modem, goes across talking to the tower, to the radio access network, and then in 3G it goes to this atrocity called the SGSN, the GPRS service node. Same problem as the Apple ones. There's a lot of queue here. This is a high bandwidth path. This is a smart chip. You get packets that end up queuing here, and we could put the algorithm here. Actually, we can't, but Apple or Google could if they really wanted to. It would take somebody like Qualcomm to put it here. The problem may not be here. The problem may be there. It's hard to tell. So again, to fix this problem, you need to go talk to the people that own those various parts of the hardware ecosystem and try and get CODL in place. So it's a while to deploy it to take an effect, but we've started that. And I'll say thanks to these parties who I previously mentioned. Sorry for going over questions.
Hi, Chris Donnelly from Cable Labs. I'd be happy to talk to you offline about the DOCSIS network and how queuing is done and what could possibly be done in the future.
That'd be one for actually. Kathy Nichols is sitting right next to you there, so why don't we all get together?
Stuart Cheshire, Apple. Thanks for a wonderful presentation. I particularly like that you started with the picture of the LA freeway and then pointed out that that's garbage because I think we have a very big danger that we have comfortable metaphors for reasoning about things, and if the metaphor is a terrible metaphor but it's comfortable, there's a tendency to reason about it anyway, even if it doesn't represent the real problem. So I'm really glad. I'm so tired of seeing freeway traffic congestion as a metaphor for network congestion. I'm glad that's been debunked.
I'm really glad you made that point. So it's the way that you deal with congestion is do things like congestion-based pricing. So AT&T raises the rates and lowers the caps on their sucky network to say, oh, the delays that you're seeing are because of congestion. They're not because of congestion. I've gone in and done detailed tomographic measurements of that network. There is zero evidence of congestion. It's not there. It's buffer bloat at various places in the network, some of which can be fixed because they're external to AT&T, some of which will probably never be fixed because they're internal to AT&T. But there's no evidence of congestion, and we're paying for it. We've got these ridiculously low usage caps supposedly to increase, lower the congestion and increase the usability of the network. I didn't notice the usability increase when AT&T cut my usage by a factor of 5. No one did, because it's not a congestion problem.
So your action item here is we need to see this in the places that the queues are building up. So that means the DSL modems, the cable modems.
iPhones.
And in terms of your last picture, you had the bottleneck being from the device driver to the device.
Yeah.
I think in reality, in the middle line, the device driver ships the packets to the device pretty quickly. They're then sitting in firmware buffers waiting for the transmission medium to become available. So the principle is right. I just think that you need the line one step further to the right on that picture.
So it's the high bits are find the place where the queue really is, because putting a queue management algorithm where there's no queue, where you've got a queue in series with a queue in the upstream one.
You can't manage a queue you don't have.
Yes. And so find the real one and fix it. And in most of these areas, the work that we feel needs to be done is we need to find the real one, convince yourself, yep, I know that the queue is really there. And then you have to kind of look hard at how it's behaving in order to fix it. And these are sort of the people we'd like to partner with to find the queue and fix it.
Thank you. Yeah, Fred Baker, Cisco. Comment and a question. You commented on wireless or on Wi-Fi. And on Wi-Fi, when I went back to our hardware people and said, what does it take to get an appropriate AQM algorithm into this? What they told me was that they actually wanted to maximize the queue depth. That may sound strange. Their problem is that moving the beam around, I want to talk to that device, now I want to talk to that device, now I want to talk to that device. Moving the beam takes a certain amount of time. And if they keep the queues really shallow, they can wind up with less than 10% utilization simply because they're spending all their time moving the beam. So they actively want to keep the queues somewhat full. We could use some guidance as to where that trade-off works out there. So, as you think about such things, we could use some guidance there. The question, looking at Incast in data centers. Now, one of the attributes of that in certain nameless customers of mine is that a request goes from process A to process B. Process B asks 5,000 of its best friends what they think about it. Said best friends, all of them reply using TCP. Why TCP? Don't ask me. I didn't design it. But so they get 4,000 thanks but no thanks, I don't have anything for you, and the other 500 to 1,000 have a few segments. And as a result, the AQM algorithm in the intervening switch starts heaving packets because all of a sudden, and this might happen every 10 milliseconds, all of a sudden, it's got a very deep queue that it's allowing to peter out. And that results in a head-of-line blocking problem for that particular thread. And by the way, the next thread that asks the question and is stuck behind the TCP. I'd really like to be able to think in terms of Ekin in this. What do we have to do to get Codel interacting with Ekin and therefore not dropping the packets, but signaling congestion when appropriate?
So the answer for Linux is nothing, just turn it on. It's...
It hasn't worked that way in our
stuff. So, sorry, there are some details to work out, but in terms of the mechanism, it really doesn't matter how you signal drops. I've got a belief, I think, supported by data that ECN doesn't work and will probably never work on the general internet, not because of technical issues, but because its incentive structure is completely wrong. But it's a great thing in a data center, and CODL is, we believe, the right way to set the congestion experience bit because of it
that
works really nicely.
That forces me into the head of line blocking issue.
So I think the model that Eric is using for his FSQ is almost right. He's doing actually DRR, and he should be doing packet-based RR, and I think that Mr. Briscoe has written a nice ID saying why you should be packet-based and not byte-based. It's not about being fair. It's about getting good mixing. And so you can do something very cheap, which is a packet-based RR, very simple hash to spread things out, recombine them well mixed, and that gets rid of the HOL. The fact that CODL works no matter how you spread things out, it works on the aggregate behavior on the output.
Just to jump in, can we take this offline, please?
Yes.
So we're running really out of time. I think I want to take one more question from Andrew, and then we go for the next one. Thank you.
Andrew McGregor, just commenting that I don't think Fred's beam steering wireless problem or the 11N aggregation problem are that nasty. It comes down to the device has a requirement for a certain amount of queue in its output queues, which means that the correct level of good minimum of minimum queue is non-zero, but it doesn't mean it needs to be large, and it's not that large of a tweak to do that. And code-wise, I'm not sure moving CoddleDQ down to the bottom of a Linux wireless driver is that hard, but other stacks may vary.
Can you come up, Bob, and let's thank Van.